Go home, Cassandra said. People are waiting to greet you. They remounted and, riding side by side, with barely a meter between them, so they could reach across and hold each other's hand, continued in a contented silence up the grassy hill toward the castle. As they came close to the sentries at the outer end of the drawbridge, Cassandra released Maddie's hand and turned to face her. "I wouldn't mention that little matter to your father," she said in a low voice. "You know how he tends to worry." "How he tends to worry?" Maddie repeated incredulously. Then, realizing that her mother was deadly serious, she nodded acquiescence. "He'll never hear a word from me." Because, knowing her mother, she had a pretty good idea where and when her father would hear about the encounter on the track. There followed several hours where staff and old friends welcomed Maddie home as she did the rounds of the massive castle, greeting people she had known for years. First and foremost, of course, was her father. Horace swept her off her feet in a massive bear hug as she dismounted in the courtyard, holding her well off the ground and spinning her round, saying her name over and over. Finally, having greeted just about everyone, with the exception of her grandfather, King Duncan, she and her parents retired to their apartment in the central keep tower for a private family dinner. "You can say hello to Father tomorrow," Cassandra told her. "He's very weak these days, and he's resting." "I had hoped he might be feeling better," Maddie said, sadness touching her voice. But Horace shook his head. "He's not recovering at all. He's getting worse each day. I'm glad you came home. This could be your last chance to see him." She felt tears burning against the back of her eyes. She had known for some time that Duncan's health was deteriorating, which was why her mother had assumed the role of regent in his name. But recognizing that they could soon lose him saddened her immensely. She was quiet for a few minutes, dealing with the knowledge. Horace put his arm gently around her shoulders. "But you're home now, and who's to say he won't make a recovery?" he said. She forced the tears back and managed a smile. She was genuinely delighted to see her parents once more, and looked forward to exchanging stories with her father, and finding out more about his and Gillen's planned expedition to deal with the mysterious Red Fox clan. In the back of her mind, she was already scheming to see if she could accompany them. They sat down to one of her favourite meals, slow-roasted lamb shoulder, flavoured with rosemary and wild garlic, accompanied by crisp roasted potatoes and steamed greens. The richly flavoured meat had been roasting in a covered iron camp kettle for almost 3 hours, and it simply fell from the bone as she plunged her knife and eating fork into it. "Mmm, that's good," she said. "That's as good as Jenny makes it." Her mother smiled. She had actually prepared the meal herself. "It's Jenny's recipe," she said, "but I'm glad you approve of my cooking." They ate in pleasurable silence for several minutes, and then Horace set down his eating implements and studied his daughter. She looked older, he thought, and then realized that she was older, and that at her age, a year was a relatively large amount of time. She looked fit and healthy, and there was a new air of confidence about her, one that he approved of. Unlike his wife, he was more than happy that Maddie was training as a ranger. She was learning tactical and strategic skills, and the ability to analyze a situation quickly and intelligently, which would come in handy when she finally took the throne. "So, what have you been up to?" he asked. Instantly, Cassandra unleashed a pent-up torrent of words. What has she been up to? I'll tell you. She was set upon by robbers, barely a half-day's ride from here, attacked, and had to fight for her life. We're lucky to have her with us still, and it's your fault.
My fault?
Horace said mildly. She nodded vigorously, pointing an accusing fork in his direction so that he recoiled slightly. Your fault for encouraging her to go ahead with this ranger business, instead of staying safe at home with us. He looked at her steadily until she subsided, a little red-faced and embarrassed by her outburst.
So what happened?
He asked Maddie. It was nothing, Dad, really. They were three clumsy thugs who tried to hold us up. I took one down with my sling, Ingrid brained the second, and Bumper took care of the third.
Then what did you do with them?
Maddie shrugged. We tied them up and handed them off to a manor lord along the way, a Sir Gerald something or other.
That'd be Sir Gerald Walden, Horace said. I'll send him a note of thanks.
Then he grinned. You say Ingrid brained one? Maddie returned the smile. With her riding crop, knocked him cross-eyed with the hilt. Horace looked impressed.
Well, good for her.
He caught Cassandra's eye and nodded toward the platter of lamb.
I wonder, could you serve me a couple more slices? He said. It's very good.
Cassandra sighed and shook her head at his total lack of concern. You're obviously not a mother, she said. Horace raised his eyebrows.
Thank goodness for that.
8. The following day, Cassandra hosted a fair in the parklands outside the castle walls, so that the entire district could welcome Maddie home properly. All of the castle staff were there, along with those of the guards who were off duty, and the residents of the local village, who turned out en masse. In addition, local nobles and other villagers from 10 kilometres around made the journey to Castle Araluen for the big day. They weren't disappointed, even though some of them walked all the way to get there. There were massive cooking pits full of glowing charcoal, with lambs, boar, and sides of beef turning slowly on spits over them, operated by muscular, sweating castle kitchen staff, who paused in their labour only long enough to allow the cook's apprentices to slice juicy pieces of roasted meat from the outside of the slowly turning carcasses. A few metres away, racks of brown, crusty pastries and pies were on offer as well. There were stalls selling fruit and brightly coloured puddings for those with a sweet tooth, and barrels of wine and ale were propped up on trestles to ease the collective thirst. For the younger attendees, there was lemon-flavoured water, sweetened with sugar, a rare treat for many of the village children, and one that they took full advantage of. There was entertainment as well, with jugglers, acrobats, jongleurs, and musicians scattered at intervals throughout the park. And, of course, there was the usual array of sideshows and stalls offering tests of skill, such as hoopla, where a careful observer might have noticed that the wooden hoops looked suspiciously smaller than the prizes they had to be thrown over to win. Apples floated in a barrel for people to dunk for, blowing bubbles and snorting water as they attempted to secure one of the slippery, bobbing pieces of fruit from the water, often immersing their entire head in the barrel as a result. Young men from the village could test their strength against a huge, heavily muscled bald man in a ragged, leopard-skin loincloth. They would sit on opposite sides of a bench and arm-wrestle him, but he was a cunning competitor, with skill exceeding even his brute strength, and a sense of timing that invariably allowed him to launch the first attack in the contest,
He rarely lost. A Punch and Judy tent provided shamefully violent entertainment for the younger children, who shrieked with laughter as Judy belaboured her unfortunate husband with a cudgel made of layers of split wood, which gave off a very satisfying crack whenever she made contact. More shrieks came from a stall where older children were invited to pin the tail on a donkey. The contestants found it more entertaining to peek below their blindfold and stab the pin violently into the oversized backside of the fat knight who was leading the donkey in the colourful illustration. One contestant, overcome with the spirit of the whole thing, managed to shove her pin into the behind of the unfortunate carnival worker who was running the stall. More shrieks greeted that effort, including a very loud one from the victim, who didn't see it coming. Among the visiting noblemen and knights, Horace spied Sir Gerald Walden of Tunbridge Manor. He approached the elderly knight and nodded a friendly greeting. "Sir Gerald," he said, "I owe you my thanks for assisting my daughter." Sir Gerald, who had just bitten into a hot pie, held up a hand in apology as he negotiated the hot meat and gravy and the delicious flaky pastry. He gulped, burning his tongue and the roof of his mouth as he swallowed the mouthful, then had to take a deep draught on the tankard of ale he held in his left hand before he could reply.
"Your pardon, my lord," he mumbled, wiping his mouth with the back of his hand.
Horace smiled and waited patiently. He'd had no intention of embarrassing the older knight. "Take your time, Sir Gerald. There's no rush," he said easily. Sir Gerald swallowed another mouthful of ale to cool his scalded mouth, then made a small bobbing movement that was halfway between a bow and a curtsy.
"I meant to say, my lord, I was delighted to be of service to Princess Madeline,"
he finally managed to enunciate. Horace gave him a moment or two to settle down before continuing. "If you like, I'll send some men to take those ruffians off your hands. I wouldn't want you burdened with them."
"No burden, my lord. They're more than earning their way. We have a lot of heavy labouring that needs doing round the village, and they're taking care of it. My people are enjoying having their services available. Only this morning, they cleaned out the cesspit by the inn. Hasn't been done for some time, and my villagers were happy to have somebody else do it for them."
Horace had been impressed by Maddie's intelligent solution to the matter of punishment for the would-be robbers. Far better to have them performing menial and necessary tasks round the village than undergo the more drastic punishment of hanging or removing a hand from the guilty party.
"Very well," he said, "but make sure you let me know if they become a nuisance, or if you run out of cesspits to empty." "I'll do that, my lord," Sir Gerald replied, taking another bite of his pie, which had cooled sufficiently to make that a more comfortable matter.
Horace reached out and touched his forearm.
"No need to, my lord, me, Sir Gerald," he said. "I'm no lord. I'm a simple knight like yourself. You can address me as Sir Horace."
Horace was a staunch egalitarian. He had no use for high-flying titles that he considered he hadn't earned.
Sir Gerald nodded several times. "Yes, my... yes, Sir Horace," he amended.
He found it difficult to believe that a man married to the future queen of the realm wouldn't adorn himself with titles and decorations. But he'd heard that Sir Horace was, at heart, a simple, unassuming man. Unassuming, perhaps, but still the deadliest knight in the kingdom. Horace nodded and moved off. He'd seen Maddie through the crowd, heading for the archery range at the foot of the slope, where the ground levelled out and allowed room for targets and butts to be set up. Maddie had paid the storekeeper a 5-pennig piece for 3 shots and was studying the bows and arrows available for use with a critical eye. Several of the bow limbs were warped, the weapons being not much better than the one that had been used to threaten her the previous day. The arrows were missing fletching. Most of them had only 2 veins attached, and many of the shafts were twisted. Most of those paying to compete didn't seem to notice. Their eyes were on the array of rich prizes that were available for a good score. Bows twanged, and arrows skittered off toward the targets 30 meters away. Many of the arrows twisted in flight and slid past to impact the straw bales acting as a backstop behind the targets. Others plunged downward after only a few meters, burying their points in the soft turf. The married couple running the stall looked highly pleased with the results so far. No good archer would attempt to shoot with the shoddy bows they had on offer, which meant their customers were all people who knew little or nothing about archery. Maddie selected a bow that had more or less even limbs, with only a slight warp in the lower one. She scanned the arrows on offer, and quickly chose 3 that were almost straight and had 4 sets of flights. She tested the draw weight to the bow. It couldn't have been more than 30 pounds. She'd need to aim high over a 30-meter range. She set an arrow on the string.
3 arrows in the red circle to win a prize, my lady, said the storekeeper's wife.
The red circle was the innermost circle of the target. Don't show off, said a voice close by. She turned and saw her father standing just behind her. Remember, he continued, you're supposed to be a helpless young maiden, not a dead shot. She smiled lazily. Then, barely seeming to aim, she drew and shot in 1 clean movement. The arrow thudded into the center of the red circle.
Ooh, I hit it! I hit it!
She squealed in what she imagined sounded like girlish excitement, dropping the bow and clapping her hands with joy. Horace raised his eyes to heaven. He said softly. She grinned at him and took up her 2nd arrow, noting that while she'd been looking away, the storekeeper had substituted a very warped example in place of the shaft she'd selected. She knocked and drew back, holding the bow awkwardly and pinching the nock of the arrow between her forefinger and thumb. She let her bow hand waver with the strain, frowned heavily, and aimed for a dead center shot, trusting that the arrow would never manage such a result. She shot. The arrow flipped away, twisting in the air so that it flashed past the right side of the target, burying its head in the wall of straw bales behind it.
Ooh, I missed, she squealed in disappointment.
Horace rolled his eyes again. Is there a prize for hitting the hay bales? She asked, hopefully.
3 arrows in the red circle for a prize, my lady, intoned the storekeeper's wife stolidly.
Surreptitiously, her husband was reaching for the remaining straight arrow, hoping to substitute another bent shaft. Without seeming to notice, Maddie reached down and picked up the arrow before he could take it. Smoothly, she knocked it and shot. This time, the arrow thudded into the red circle of the target next to hers. She turned a winning smile on the storekeeper.
Is that worth anything? She asked.
He shook his head.
3 arrows in your own red circle for a prize, my lady, he said, offering her 3 more shafts. Care to buy another 3?
She shook her head. I think I had beginner's luck, she said, smiling sweetly. And the bows seem awfully dangerous. Beside her, Horace groaned. She gave him a conspiratorial smile, and they walked away, arm in arm, heading back up the slope toward the castle. The afternoon was drawing on, and the shadows were growing longer. There was a cool nip in the air as well.
"Enjoying yourself?" he asked.
She nodded. "Yes, it's fine to see everyone again. A lot of old faces I've been missing." She looked around the crowded park, smiling happily. She knew that in a couple of days she would become bored with the restrictions of castle life and her position, and be longing for the freedom and activity of life as a ranger. But for now, she was content.
"You look as if you've used a bow before," a voice said behind her.
She turned to see the speaker and was pleasantly surprised. He was in his mid-twenties, tall and lean, with broad shoulders. He was clean-shaven, with a strong, square jaw, straight nose, and even white teeth, which she could see because he was smiling. He was handsome, undoubtedly so. His hair was dark blonde and slightly shorter than was fashionable. His eyes were clear blue, with a mischievous twinkle to them. It was that, she thought, more than anything else that made him attractive. She noticed he was dressed in the uniform of the palace guard, a captain, judging by the silver rank insignia on his right shoulder. Instinctively, she liked him.
"Just luck," she said, returning the smile. "Beginner's luck."
He cocked his head to one side, and those eyes told her he didn't believe her. But he'd let her get away with the pretense.
"If you say so."
He nodded a respectful greeting to Horace.
"Good afternoon, Sir Horace," he said. "I take it this is the Princess Madeline we've been waiting for."
"Afternoon, Diamond," Horace replied. "Yes, this is her. Maddie, this is Diamond, one of our brighter young officers. Diamond, this is Princess Madeline."
Diamond came to attention and bowed his head briefly in her direction. Maddie was pleased he didn't perform an elaborate sweeping bow with one leg pushed forward and his arm tracing a half circle in the air. She was always vaguely suspicious of such overblown actions.
"Delighted to meet you, Your Highness," he said.
His eyes continued to twinkle, as if he were sharing some secret joke with her. His manner was friendly but respectful. He wasn't overawed by her rank or the presence of her father. She liked that. Diamond was obviously a young man, confident in his own abilities.
"Call me Maddie," she said, inclining her head to him in return. "All my friends do."
"Then I'm pleased to be included among them," he said. "I hope I'll see more of you while you're back with us."
"I'm sure you will," Maddie said.
Horace had been eyeing the two of them during all this. They were obviously attracted to each other. Not surprising, he thought. They were both attractive young people. He felt a surge of fatherly protectiveness. He hadn't had to deal with Maddie and boys before. It was a new experience for him.
"Perhaps Diamond will find time to take you hunting while I'm gone," he said.
"I'll make time," the young captain said. "I'm eager to see you shoot again, with a decent bow next time."
"That first shot was the merest fluke," she said. "Actually, I prefer the sling as a weapon." Diamond nodded reflectively.
"Like your mother," he said. "I hear she's an excellent shot."
"I'm better," said Maddie boldly. "But then I have more time to practice. I'm not busy running a kingdom."
"I hope to see you demonstrate your skill," Diamond said.
He looked to Horace.
"If you'll excuse me, sir, I'm on duty at the fourth hour, so I'd better get back to the castle.
Princess Maddie," he said,
"I'll be seeing you again."
"I look forward to it," Maddie told him.
Diamond turned and strode away toward the castle, his long legs eating up the distance. Maddie looked at her father, noticing the slightly bewildered look on his face.
"He's nice," she said. "Where did he come from? I don't remember him."
"He joined us about 6 months ago," Horace told her. "He's very bright. He's already been promoted twice."
"Will he be going with you and Gillen?"
"No," her father said. "He'll be here in command of the garrison."
Maddie's smile widened. "Good," she said. 9. There was a lot of catching up for Maddie to do over the next few days. First and foremost, she wanted to see her grandfather. He was in a sunny room on the fourth floor, where he stayed bedridden for most of each day. She checked with the medical orderly on duty in his anteroom to make sure he was awake and she wouldn't be disturbing him. Then she tapped lightly on the door and entered. She was shocked at how old he looked. Duncan had always been a big, cheerful presence, with a personality that seemed to fill any room he was in. But the weight had fallen off him, so that he was a shadow of his former robust self. His cheeks were hollow, and his eyes were sunken in his face. And his hair, which she remembered as a distinguished salt and pepper colour, was now white. But the smile was the same. He was delighted to see her. They had always been close. She perched on the edge of his bed, and they talked for an hour or so. He quizzed her keenly about her training and her progress in the Ranger Corps. She discovered that he heartily approved of her decision to stay with Will after her first year.
"You'll rule this country one day," he told her. "Your time as a ranger will be more use to you than any amount of needlework and ladylike skills. You'll need to be able to lead men, to command in battles, and to plan strategy. Nothing will teach you that better than ranger training."
Duncan had a high regard for Will and Halt. Halt, of course, had been one of the first rangers to support him in his battle with Morgareth long ago. And Will, as an apprentice, had been instrumental in foiling Morgareth's final attempt at taking the throne. She spent a pleasant hour with him, regaling him with tales of her adventures with Will, of brigands and highwaymen, outwitted and captured, and Hibernian pirates, who insisted on using the west coast of the kingdom as a sanctuary from their own officials, and who had to be discouraged from time to time. She told the stories with a rich vein of self-deprecating humour, and was pleased to see the light in her grandfather's eye, and hear his deep laughter as she made herself the butt of many of the stories. Eventually, she noticed that he was tiring. He smothered a yawn once or twice, and she realized she should let him rest. She kissed him lightly on the forehead and took her leave. As she reached the door, he called to her and she turned back. He waved a hand at her.
"Thanks for coming, Maddie.
Come again any time."
"I will, Grandpa," she promised.
Then his eyes slid shut, and his breathing became deep and regular. Back in the royal apartments, she found a brief note from Gillen. "Riding kit, stables, 11th hour." She glanced at the water clock set by the window, and realized she had less than 10 minutes before the deadline he had set. She quickly changed into riding gear, as befitted Princess Madeline, not Ranger Maddie, and made her way down the stairs in a rush, erupting from the main doorway into the courtyard and running full tilt across the cobbles to the large stable building. Gillen was waiting for her in the dim, shady interior. She noticed with some surprise that he had Sundancer and Bumper both saddled, along with Blaze, his own ranger horse. He gestured for her to mount Sundancer, and swung up easily into Blaze's saddle. Bumper, ears pricked and alert, followed them as they trotted out of the stables and across the courtyard.
"Where are we going?" she asked. Gillen held a finger to his lips in a signal for silence. "When we're outside," he said. They trotted across the drawbridge, the hooves of their horses clopping and clattering in their three separate rhythms. Then Gillen swung southwest. "I thought you'd want to ride Bumper while you're here," he said. She nodded confirmation of the fact. "Of course." Once they were in the trees and hidden from the castle, she switched horses, swinging into Bumper's saddle with a satisfied sigh. She had missed her horse over the past few days. "Right," Gillen continued. "Well, we could hardly have people querying why you'd ride such a scruffy little barrel when you had a perfectly good Oridan at your disposal." He nodded toward Sundancer. True to his name, the Oridan's glossy coat gleamed in the late morning sun. Bumper snorted indignantly. "Scruffy little barrel indeed." Gillen turned and looked suspiciously at him. Like all rangers, he talked to his horse and believed the horse talked back. But like all rangers, he never mentioned it to anyone else, and he wondered if other rangers and their horses had the same communication. He suspected that Maddie and Bumper did, but it would never do to ask. "So?" Maddie said, prompting him. She'd noticed he was distracted from his train of thought, but didn't know why. He recovered himself hastily. "So I've arranged for a farmer and his wife who live nearby to keep Bumper in their barn while you're here. You can ride out to their farm on Sundancer, switch horses, and explore the district on Bumper." She grinned, delighted by the idea. She'd been wondering how she would spend time riding Bumper while she was here. As he'd said, it would appear suspicious if she ignored her supposedly superior Oridan to ride what appeared to be a shaggy pack pony. "Who's this farming couple?" she asked. "Warwick is a little more than a farmer," Gillen said. "He's actually one of my intelligence agents, and he keeps an eye on things in the area. Lets me know if anything suspicious is going on. He's a very useful fellow. Louise, his wife, is a skillful observer as well." He paused a few seconds, then added, "They know you're with the Corps, but they'll never tell anyone." "Interesting," she said. She'd suspected that Gillen had a network of agents keeping him informed, but this was the first time she'd had the suspicion confirmed. 5 minutes later, they reached the farm, and as they rode into the home yard, Warwick and Louise hurried out to greet them. If Maddie had had any preformed idea about what a secret agent looked like, Warwick definitely didn't fit it. He was short and stocky, in his mid to late 30s. With a cheery, welcoming grin that seemed to be always present on his face. His eyes crinkled above the smile, and above that he was completely bald on top, with only a fringe of brown hair around his ears and the lower back of his head. He looked very fit and moved with an obvious agility. His forearms, bare beneath the short sleeves of his linen shirt, were thick with muscle. His wife was a few centimetres taller than him, slim and darkly pretty. She had a lazy, knowing smile that constantly touched the corners of her mouth. Her dark eyes looked steadily at Maddie as she studied her. The younger girl guessed it would take a lot to surprise Louise. "Louise, Warwick, this is Maddie, the fellow ranger I spoke to you about," Gillen said. Warwick gestured for Maddie to dismount. Good manners dictated that one always waited to be invited to do so. She swung down from Bumper's saddle, and Gillen did likewise. "Welcome to our farm, Maddie," said Warwick, his grin wide and friendly. He reached up and rubbed Bumper's soft nose gently. "And I'm guessing this is Bumper." Bumper tossed his head at the sound of his name.
Warwick laughed and reached into a pocket to produce a carrot, which he fed to the little horse from the flattened palm of his hand. Bumper crunched the vegetable, then swung his eyes to Maddie.
"I like this one."
And that was enough for Maddie. The surest way to her heart was to win over her horse, which Warwick had done easily. She smiled at him.
"You've made a new friend," she said.
Warwick nodded happily.
"He's a beauty," he said. "Reckon he could run all the day if you asked him."
"And half the night," Maddie agreed.
"I'll unsaddle him and settle him in the barn," Warwick told her. "Lou has some coffee just made. Go on into the house and have a cup."
"Never been known to refuse," Gillen grinned. "Lou makes great coffee."
Maddie tethered Sundancer to a post by the front door of the farmhouse. Blaze, of course, didn't need to be secured. She would wait patiently for Gillen, with her reins dropped loosely onto the ground before her. They entered the farmhouse, Maddie blinking in the sudden dimness after the bright sunshine outside. It was a typical small farm building, with the ground floor divided into areas for eating, cooking, and relaxing. A short ladder led to an upper loft, which Maddie assumed was their bedroom. The rooms were furnished with simple but well-made furniture. Two comfortable-looking wooden armchairs were set on either side of the fireplace, with thick cushions in place to soften the hardwood seats. There was a small dining table, with benches on either side to seat four people. Louise led them to this now and gestured for them to sit. She fetched the coffee pot from the edge of the fire and poured them a mug each. Then she pushed a pot of honey forward.
"We know you rangers have a sweet tooth," she said with a smile.
Maddie returned the smile and helped herself to a generous dollop of honey in the steaming, fragrant coffee. She took a sip. Gillen was right. The woman made excellent coffee. A few minutes later, Warwick rejoined them. He patted Maddie's arm.
"Your boy is settled in nicely, with a big bin of oats and some fresh water. He's looking very happy."
"And you can come and see him any time you like," Louise added. "Stay the night, if you want to."
"Thanks," Maddie told them. "It's nice to know he's in good hands."
"Oh yes, oh yes," said Warwick, rubbing his hands together. "We like ranger horses on this farm."
He took a sip of the coffee Lou had poured for him and smacked his lips in appreciation.
"Good brew, Lou," he said. Then he laughed. "I made a rhyme."
"We noticed," Lou said dryly. But she gave him an affectionate look all the same.
"So, Warwick," Gillen said, "has anything been going on in the area?"
Warwick gathered his thoughts before he spoke. Maddie noticed that the easy grin disappeared from his face as he did. This was official, she realized.
"They say there have been lights up in that old abbey again," he said. "I've been out several times to check, but they've never been there when I've been watching."
"Are your informants reliable?" Gillen asked.
Warwick shifted on his bench.
"I wouldn't say they were totally reliable," he said, "but they've mentioned it several times over the past month. There may be something going on."
"Or nothing,"
Lou put in cynically.
"People can talk themselves into seeing things, and seeing lights in an old building can easily be a trick of the moonlight."
Gillen rubbed his chin. "Possibly," he said.
"Or maybe travellers passing through have been sheltering there. But keep an eye on it anyway. If you get definite news of something odd while I'm away, pass the news on to Maddie here."
Maddie looked at him in some surprise. He saw the look and shrugged.
"You're a fourth-year apprentice now. I trust your judgment, and Will says you're more than capable of handling tricky situations.
In fact, I've been planning to ask you to keep an eye on the thief while I'm away. Maybe patrol the area 2 or 3 times a week. He switched his gaze to Warwick. But if you do see something up there, don't go and investigate by yourself. I don't want you taking risks. Warwick looked serious for a moment, and then the grin spread across his face again. You don't want me taking risks, but you'd send a slip of a girl up there to investigate. Gillen nodded seriously. This slip of a girl, as you call her, can knock the eyeballs out of a gnat with her sling, without even having to think about it. Warwick regarded her with new respect, as did Lou. Maddie felt herself reddening. That might be a bit of an exaggeration, she said. I can really only knock the head off a gnat. We don't do eyeballs until 5th year. I find that more believable, Lou said with a slow smile. Anyone for more coffee? 10. On the way home, they passed the training ground where the cavalry were exercising their remounts. Each trooper travelling with Horace and Gillen would take 2 horses, so that the troop could travel more quickly without tiring the horses unduly. As Horace had observed, the bulk of the herd had been out to grass for several months and had been skittish about being saddled and ridden once more. The troopers were getting them accustomed to the necessary discipline. "Looks like they're nearly ready," Maddie remarked. Gillen nodded, eyeing the horses as they formed 4s, and then an extended line, then went to a trot, increasing tempo to a canter, and then a full gallop, while maintaining their formation. A few of the horses still shied and tugged at the reins, tossing their heads against the restricting bits, but overall they were well behaved. After all, you never wanted a cavalry horse to become too docile. A bit of wildness could be a good thing. "So you'll be leaving tomorrow," Maddie said. There was a note of wistfulness in her voice. Gillen turned his attention from the horses to her. "Mid-morning," he said. "That'll give us time to get well on the way before we camp for the night."
"Don't suppose I could go with you?" she said a little plaintively. "I could be quite useful, you know."
"Yes, you could, and no, you can't," Gillen replied, smiling. "I don't want your mother mounting my head on a spike over the battlements. You're here to see her, not to come traipsing off with us to the northern part of the fief."
"I'm here to see Dad as well," she said. But her half-hearted tone said she knew she was arguing in vain.
"And you'll see him when we come back. We should only be a couple of weeks. Besides, I'll feel better knowing you're looking after things here."
"You're not just saying that to make me feel better about staying here." He shook his head firmly.
"I don't do that. And I meant what I said. You're going into your 4th year of training. You should be able to cope with anything that crops up."
Not that he expected anything out of the ordinary. Araluin was a well-organized, well-disciplined fief, as befitted the seat of the capital. But you could never be sure, as the incident with the 3 brigands had indicated.
"Don't worry. You'll have plenty to do to keep you busy," he said. "And if you get bored, you could always spend your time trying to find the old secret tunnels in the castle."
Maddie pricked up her ears at that.
"Tunnels? What tunnels?"
He waved a hand vaguely in the air.
"Oh, possibly just rumour and old wives' tales," he said. "The castle is supposed to be honeycombed with tunnels and secret stairways behind the walls. Duncan's grandfather was reputed to have a secret exit that led under the moat.
he apparently used to pop out secretly to visit his girlfriend in the village. That was before he was married, of course, he added, in a very proper tone. Maddie said nothing further, but she was thoughtful for the rest of the ride home. Secret tunnels and stairways sounded like a fascinating subject to explore. Giller noticed her preoccupation and smiled at her. He'd known that mention of secret tunnels would fire her imagination. She was a ranger, after all, and rangers had an active curiosity and interest in such matters. The small force left the following morning, as Gillen had predicted. Maddie and Cassandra both embraced Horace and Gillen, and stood by the portcullis gate as the horsemen and archers filed through in pairs. Each pair nodded a salute to Cassandra as they passed, and she favoured them all with a brilliant smile. Maddie, watching her, realised how popular she was with her soldiers, probably as a result of her background as a fighter and adventurer herself. They respected her courage and her fighting ability, and her grasp of tactics and strategy. They knew she would never set them a task they couldn't perform. The two women watched as the small force disappeared into the tree line at the bottom of the hill. For a few moments, a slight haze of dust marked where they had passed, and then the breeze dispersed it, and all was silent. "Well, that's that," Cassandra said, and turned to go back into the castle keep. "I suppose you're used to seeing Dad ride off to battle," Maddie said, as they strolled back across the cobbles. She knew that Horace had ridden out many times over the years to suppress local rebellions, or hunt down bands of robbers and outlaws. Cassandra nodded. "Used to it, but I never like it." "He can look after himself," Maddie said. After all, she knew her father was the foremost knight in the kingdom. His achievements and abilities were legendary. "I know," her mother replied, "but there's always the chance something can go wrong. A broken stirrup leather or a loose saddle girth, for example. Some things are outside his control." Maddie's expression grew worried. "Thanks," she said. "You've just ruined my day for me." Cassandra smiled. Her negative frame of mind was more the result of knowing she would miss Horace over the next few weeks. The two were very much in love, and in truth, she knew he could look after himself, broken stirrups or saddle girths notwithstanding. "He'll be fine, don't worry," she said reassuringly. "I'm just a little blue because he's going, and besides, he has Gillen to look after him." Conscious of the need to keep her daughter occupied, knowing that palace life could become boring and restrictive for her, she added casually, "I have a session with my Keru in 15 minutes. Care to come and watch?" "I'd love to," Maddie said enthusiastically. "Dad said he's remarkable, and I've never seen a Nihon Jan swordsman in action." When Cassandra had first visited Nihon Ja, the Emperor had been fascinated by the fact that both she and Alice, Will's future wife, were trained in swordsmanship, arming themselves with lightweight sabres. There was no tradition of female warriors in Nihon Ja, and the Emperor, Shigeru, had decided that perhaps it might be a good thing if there were. The Emperor had sensed that the Nihon Jan form of swordsmanship, which relied on speed and agility more than brute force, might well be suited to a woman's abilities. Cassandra and Horace, of course, had a large estate in Nihon Ja, a wedding gift from the Emperor. But with Duncan ill, they had not had an opportunity to visit their lands in the far-distant kingdom for many years. To make up for their inability to travel, and knowing Cassandra's interest in martial arts, 2 years ago, the Emperor had decided to send Maikeru to her. Maikeru was a slightly built, wiry man. There wasn't an ounce of fat on his body. His hair was grey, and he was obviously in his 60s. Yet he moved lightly and without difficulty, and his swordplay was a wonder to behold.
"I bring you two gifts from Emperor Shigeru," he'd said when he first met Cassandra. He had held out a long parcel wrapped in oilcloth.
She had stepped forward to take it from him and unwrap the oilskin. Inside was a Nihonjan katana, the long sword favoured by the Senshi warriors of the Sunrise Land. It was sheathed in a beautifully lacquered black scabbard of polished wood, inlaid with mother-of-pearl shell. The blade, when she withdrew it, had a blue tinge to it, and curving lines along its length, showing where several rods of iron had been beaten together, shaped and tempered by a master swordsmith. It had a single edge, which was sharper than the sharpest razor, and a two-handed handle with a small, flat, rectangular crosspiece to protect the user's hands. It was somewhat shorter than a conventional Araluan cavalry sword, and much lighter to wield. But the blade was far harder than any in the kingdom, save for the sax knives carried by rangers, or the sword Horus wore, which had itself been fashioned by a Nihonjan craftsman many years before. "This is beautiful," she had said, sliding the blade back into its scabbard and looking around curiously. There had been nothing else in the oilskin package. "But you said two gifts. Where is the second?"
"I am the second,"
Maikeru said gravely, inclining his head to her.
"I am a swordmaster of the fourth rank, and my lord Shigeru has charged me with the task of teaching you the use of the katana."
Cassandra had been startled by the statement. "But it can take years to master the katana." Again, Maikeru had bowed to her.
"Then I will remain here until you are skilled," he said.
And so Cassandra had begun her instruction under the amazing swordmaster, learning the cuts and thrusts, when to retreat, when to attack, how to face an Araluan swordsman armed with sword and shield, how to use speed and cunning to defeat a more powerful warrior. She was an apt student, and Maikeru was pleased with her dedication and her progress. He was made welcome by Cassandra and Horus, as well as Gillen and the other warriors in the castle, and became a valued and respected member of the Araluan court. Several of the more mature ladies of the court, most of them widows, found his upright bearing, impeccable manners, and formal approach to be more than a little attractive. Maikeru had left behind no family in Nihonja. His wife had passed away many years before, and they had no children. His loyalty was to Emperor Shigeru, but gradually he transferred that to the slim princess who ruled the island kingdom. And, as the first year turned into the second, Maikeru began to think of Araluin as his home. Maikeru spent time each day with Cassandra, her other duties permitting, instructing her in the use of the katana and improving her technique. Now she would be capable of holding her own with all but the finest swordsmen in Nihonja. Today she was to practice with Daimon, as Maikeru dictated that she must learn to fight against a style dissimilar to her own. Daimon was a capable swordsman, not as skilled as Horus or Gillen, but a good match for her and a good training partner who would not feel it necessary to hold back. For the bout, they met in the armory hall, a long, bare room on the first floor of the keep. One wall was lined with tall windows that let the daylight flood into the room, providing excellent lighting for the practice bouts that were held here. There were tiered benches along the opposite wall, and Maddie found a seat there. Her mother was donning her padded practice jacket and protective leather helmet when Diamond arrived, similarly attired. He selected a wooden practice sword and shield from the rack and walked over to greet Maddie, smiling. Cassandra was armed with a wooden weapon, shaped like her katana and replicating its weight and balance.
"Nice to see you again," he said.
Maddie returned the smile. Diamond had been on duty since the day of the fair, and they hadn't seen each other in the intervening days, save for the occasional quick, friendly nod as they passed.
"Good to see you," she said.
"I have the day off tomorrow," he said. "Would you like to go hunting?"
"That'd be great," she said.
His smile widened.
"I'm keen to see how you manage a proper bow."
"I told you," she replied. "My weapon of choice is the sling."
She frowned slightly, looking at the shield on his left arm.
"Speaking of weapons, isn't my mother at a disadvantage here? She doesn't have a shield."
"So she has less to carry," he said.
But Maddie turned to Maikeru and called out across the hall.
"Maikeru-san, my mother has no shield. This isn't an even match."
She was concerned that Cassandra might be hurt. She knew Diamond was an excellent swordsman, and it seemed that he had an advantage over Cassandra's slim, wooden practice katana. Maikeru crossed the hall, his thin slippers whispering on the timber floor, scarred and marked by generations of practice weapons that had missed their mark and rebounded off the floorboards. He stopped a few meters away from Maddie and bowed briefly.
"Your mother has a shield," he said. "You just can't see it. It is half a sword length in front of her, and is activated by the movement of her katana."
Maddie frowned, not understanding. Diamond, who had been through this exercise before with Cassandra, smiled encouragingly.
"Wait and see," he said.
"If you injure my mum," she said, "I won't go hunting with you tomorrow."
Diamond acknowledged the statement with a shake of his head.
"If I injure your mum, I won't be going anywhere tomorrow myself."
Maikeru motioned the two combatants to the center of the hall. They faced each other and took up their respective positions. Diamond had his shield raised and his sword projecting halfway over the top of it. Cassandra faced him, her feet widely spaced, her katana held back over her right shoulder. Maikeru had a wooden rod in his hand. He began tapping it on the floor in a steady rhythm. Then he called,
"Commence."
11.
Maikeru continued to tap his wooden rod on the floor. Maddie realized he was setting a tempo for the practice bout. Suddenly, Diamond took a half pace forward and darted his sword out at Cassandra, chest high. Cassandra brought her sword forward and moved its tip in a small circle, catching the blade of Diamond's weapon and deflecting it to one side with a circular motion. Recovering quickly, Diamond lunged once more. The katana moved in the opposite direction now, deflecting his wooden blade to the other side. Then, as he was slightly off balance, Cassandra leapt forward and delivered three rapid cuts at him. He took the first two on his shield, then narrowly managed to block the third, a horizontal sweep at thigh level, with his own sword. The crack of their swords as they came together echoed in the armory hall. They stepped apart, resumed their ready positions, and eyed each other carefully. Maikeru increased the tempo with the wooden rod on the floor.
"Begin," he said.
This time, Cassandra was the first to attack. She swept forward, her wooden blade flashing in the air. A series of staccato cracks marked its impact with Diamond's sword and shield. The young warrior backed away,
defending desperately against the ever-changing direction and blurring speed of Cassandra's onslaught. Cassandra pursued him down the length of the armory hall, their feet shuffling and squeaking on the floorboards. But even though she was driving Diamond back,